In the coming week, the World Health Organization Executive Board convenes. Afghanistan tries to forge a peace deal amid a surge in violence. And China holds its annual session of the National People's Congress. It's May 21st, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, let's kick it right off with the coronavirus, of course, and discuss the upcoming meeting of the World Health Organization's Executive Board, virtual, of course. The Executive Board's May meeting is a follow-up to its meeting that it typically holds in January. A great deal has happened since then, goes without saying. So, Jim, could you give us a sense of what the WHO Executive Board is going to be talking about at this meeting?
Happy to, Bob. Not to put too fine a point on it, they're going to be discussing the future of the organization. As you know, President Trump sent a letter to the WHO's Director General this week stating that the United States intended to turn its temporary freeze on payments to the WHO to a permanent ban unless the WHO committed to major substantive improvements in the next 30 days. Now, that's really big news because we've discussed before on the podcast, the United States is the World Health Organization's single largest funder, though I should point out only about 6% or so of U.S. funding to the WHO goes to the pandemic response. But it's not hard to see that if the United States were to cut off all of its funding permanently for the WHO, that would really disrupt the ability of the WHO to operate. Now, President Trump sent his letter on the first day of the World Health Assembly. This is a big meeting that was done virtually, typically held in Geneva, Switzerland, in which delegations from all the WHO member states convene. Now, I'll note that President Trump had the opportunity to address the World Health Assembly, chose not to. Notable, however, that Chinese President Xi Jinping did the opposite. He gave an address to the WHA in which he said that China planned to offer more than $2 billion over the next 2 years to the World Health Organization to help it combat COVID-19. Those remarks, I think, were very well received by people. Now, we can get into questions as to whether or not the Chinese are going to make good on their pledge and also their reasons for doing so. In many ways, it is to buy some goodwill because China obviously has come under fierce criticism around the world for its handling, or should I say mishandling, of the coronavirus.
Well, and they face questioning at WHA too about the ability of them to open up for some sort of investigation, you know, looking back at what happened, right?
Oh, they did. And at the end of the day, the WHA produced a unanimous resolution. That should tell you something right there, Bob. Backing global cooperation to combat COVID-19 and an investigation into the world's response. Now, it was unanimously approved. You have the United States and China both signing off on it. That tells you that the resolution was fairly vague. And I'll note that if you look at the text of the resolution, what it says is that there will be a stepwise process of impartial, independent, and comprehensive evaluation at the earliest moment with the purpose to review experience gained and lessons learned. And the Chinese, of course, interpret this as saying that any inquiry should wait until the virus has been contained, which means they're probably never going to get around to it. But the big challenge, of course, going back to the WHO Executive Board meeting, is they're going to have to figure out how do they respond to President Trump's letter. And again, the reality with international organizations, multilateral organizations, is that these organizations can't do any more than what their members want them to do. Here you are in a situation with an international organization in which the two superpowers are at odds over what should be done. Clearly, President Trump has been blaming China for the spread of the coronavirus, and the Chinese, just as adamantly, have no intention of becoming a scapegoat for the crisis. Equal challenge for the WHO Executive Board is how exactly do you respond to President Trump's demands? If you read the letter is a long list of what he perceives to be deficiencies, failings of the WHO, was too nice to China, didn't send alerts soon enough, was critical of decisions that he, President Trump, made. The letter is short on specific tangible changes that he actually wants from the organization. So it wouldn't surprise me if some of the members of the WHO Executive Board view this more as about American domestic politics, President Trump trying to shift blame from his handling of the coronavirus here in the United States. Indeed, many people have pointed out that in the months of January and February, the president frequently praised how China was handling the coronavirus, frequently praised the WHO. And so in that sense, his criticisms of the WHO and its director general could be equally made against his own administration. But at the end of the day, they're going to have to figure out, how do you respond in a way that pleases the United States and doesn't alienate China or other countries? And there may be no overlapping space there, Bob.
Good point, Jim. I think critics of the president's response to the pandemic and his posturing towards international agencies in general note or say that in this case, it's a letter that really doesn't intend to be answered. It was set up in a way that did not really provide for any sort of reasonable answer. And that doesn't mean that there can't be some gestures from the WHO that might not satisfy the president. But I think based on the reporting in and around this decision, the president had just come out of a meeting in Camp David with some of his closest allies in Congress who were no friends of the UN and in particular the WHO. He's clearly intent on, you know, painting the WHO as among the chief villains in this pandemic. And critics would also point out that other countries were also dealing with the inadequacies of the WHO, but were able to take the information that they got from the WHO and from their own experts and respond in much more effective ways that the US did not. So it's continuing to play out against this backdrop of really sharp, almost daily US-China antagonisms on top of it all. WHO is kind of wrapped into that whole issue.
Yeah, in that sense, WHO really is sort of just caught up in forces beyond its own control. And I would note, looking at this, you know, one of the criticisms that can be fairly made of the Trump administration is, if not the WHO, then what? I mean, there's a reason why the United States has been a big supporter of the World Health Organization over the years, and that's because its mission is necessary, it's important, because diseases don't stay at home, they travel across borders. Again, a lot of the work that WHO does is in terms of helping other countries improve their health infrastructure, dealing with other infectious diseases, things like polio and the like, and it plays an important role. And so, you know, there's just a little phrase, you know, mend it, don't end it. In this case, the administration seems more about ending it, and it's not clear what would go in its place. Now, the broader context here is the Trump administration, President Trump in particular, has long been hostile, as you noted, to international organizations. He thinks they're designed to short the United States in some way. They don't work in our interest. He's left a fair number of international organizations and agreements. And just as we were sitting down to do this podcast, I saw a news flash that the United States is now leaving the Open Skies Treaty with Russia that allowed both sides to overfly each other's territory in terms of helping to enforce, verify compliance with a variety of agreements. So you sort of have domestic politics here in the United States mixed with an antagonism or a hostility toward international organizations. The real question becomes, okay, what then? What are you going to do in place of this? And I think that's the big question mark in the Trump strategy that the administration has not answered. Bob, let's turn our attention to Afghanistan. In the past few weeks, we've seen an increase in violence across the country. U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, is currently in the country. He's meeting with Afghan officials in the hopes of salvaging the previously negotiated deal to set up a process to get a peace deal. This story is in flux and could change by the hour. But can you just tell us a little bit more, Bob, about what's happening in Afghanistan right now?
Sure, Jim. Well, I think first and foremost, the attention getter is the surge in violence in Afghanistan. Of course, no stranger to this, but even by Afghanistan standards, some of the attacks reported recently are particularly grisly. There was an attack a week ago at a maternity hospital in Kabul, in which 24 people at last count, including newborn children, were shot dead. The scenes from there were just excruciating. The Taliban, it should be noted, has denied carrying out that attack. The U.S. has accepted that denial and it has cast blame on the Islamic State. There was also an attack after that maternity hospital attack, actually a couple in northern and eastern Afghanistan, in which two mosques were attacked with worshipers who were breaking their Ramadan fast, killed in the crossfire. At least 14 people killed in those attacks. And these are on top of, you know, a surge in which many people, most of them civilians, have been killed since that February peace deal signed by the United States and the Taliban. Now, that deal, Jim, was supposed to be followed by, in short order, in March, actually, by serious talks between the Taliban and Afghan officials. That has always been seen as one of the more difficult aspects of these talks because Taliban has not acknowledged Afghan as legitimate partners in negotiations, compounded by the fact that the Afghan side, the Afghan civilian government, was at loggerheads between the president, Ashraf Ghani, and the chief executive, a Abdullah Abdullah, who were contesting elections held last fall. They have just finally reached an agreement in which Ghani is going to be recognized as president. Abdullah Abdullah will have sway over at least half a dozen cabinet departments. And that was in some part, I think, prompted by U.S. threats and warnings and pressure, including the removal of $1 billion in aid to get the Afghans to find common cause so that they can then go ahead and engage the Taliban in talks. Now, the Afghan officials are blaming the Taliban for a surge in violence for a number of attacks as well. And so it still seems kind of like a very murky path, let's say, Jim, even though Mr. Khalilzad was just in the country, was said to have pressed the leadership to move forward. He had just spoken with the Taliban leadership as well in Doha, senior Taliban leadership. He continues to be very active. And there's the hope that in potentially the week ahead or the weeks ahead, you're going to see some movement and some potentially confidence building, such as increasing prisoner swaps and things like that happening between the Afghan civilian authorities and the Taliban. So a lot of movement, Jim, still some movement in seemingly in the right direction, but also a lot of skepticism and bloodshed as always in Afghanistan.
Bob, we're talking about this process to try to create a peace deal. And one of the concerns lingering in the background is how committed President Trump is to trying to create a peace process. He has been critical of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan for quite some time. Again, you go back to August of 2017, he gave the national address where he said his instincts wanted to take him one way, but his advisors convinced him to stay in Afghanistan and go a different way. As I talk to people about sort of the process of getting an Afghan peace deal, even putting aside all of the challenges you just noted about the violence, they say that the actual negotiation of a peace agreement will take months, probably more years. Do we have a sense that this administration has the kind of patience to make that happen? Or do we run the risk in 2 or 3 months from now, we simply get a tweet saying the United States is leaving Afghanistan? Because again, for this administration, I think like for a lot of presidential administrations, foreign policy isn't in its own little box. It's also tied to domestic politics. We're in an election year. The president ran saying he wanted to get out of these commitments, but we're still there.
Jim, you raise a lot of good points. I think, you know, we can start with the president, who's been very clear since he was running for president that he would like to wrap up the Afghan campaign. He had some recent comments in the past week or so. He continued to cite his frustration with the U.S. military campaign in Afghanistan. I think it was in response to a Wall Street Journal editorial where he continued to refer to it as sort of this police action where the U.S. was put in the position of being sort of policing this intractable conflict. He said, for the most part, during its almost 19 years in the country, it's not been, quote unquote, fighting to win.
And he said he was going to fight to win back in August of 2017,
right.
But that's not what we're doing.
That's not what we're doing. There are a number of parallels it's worth pointing out, Jim, to the situation involving U.S. forces in Syria, which I think it was a tweet that sort of set things in motion there as well in terms of following a conversation with the Turkish president. In that case, President Trump decided to move forces, a much smaller group of forces, by the way, the low thousands, away from northern Syria, where Turkish forces were. And in the process, coming as news, among other things, to our Kurdish allies in the region, moved U.S. forces away, created a great deal of disarray. Syria continues to be sort of chaotic, especially that part of Syria. And U.S. forces do remain a much smaller unit, but forces do remain, some of them said to be, quote unquote, guarding oil fields and so forth, but kind of a murky U.S. mandate to keep forces in Syria to some extent, and maybe some of them continuing to keep an eye out for ISIS, a resurgence of ISIS there. You can imagine in Afghanistan, there are 12,000 or so U.S. forces there. About half of them are supposed to be drawing down within, a 4 or so month period since the February deal. There are multiple signs that the U.S. is going to go ahead with that drawdown and then ultimately a complete drawdown as part of it on its own timetable. One could also imagine with concern about Taliban, you know, sort of swooping in and gaining and committing attacks and atrocities or whatever, that the U.S. might end up retaining some sort of vestigial force there, Jim. But I say that to say there's a pattern here, and there's a desire expressed repeatedly. And so I think we will be seeing sort of this gradual drawdown of U.S. forces, regardless of what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan. It must be said, regardless of the size of U.S. forces there, Afghanistan has defied armies through the centuries, fighters in Afghanistan. The Taliban are in it for the long haul, and they have kind of clawed their way back into power. If you look at a map, kind of a heat map of Afghanistan right now, there's more heat in some of the Taliban areas than there are in the civilian government's areas of control. And I think they're just kind of, they feel like they're in a good position right now with a peace partner in the U.S. eager to leave and a government that's kind of shaky at best.
But that in itself creates sort of perverse dynamics in the negotiation. negotiation process, Bob, because if the Taliban realize that the United States is really eager to go and already has one foot out the door, maybe more than one foot out the door, you don't need to give up much, or the pressure to give up more is probably lowered. It makes it harder to get a deal. In some sense, the United States is trying to chase the other side to get agreement. But there's also the possibility that if the United States leaves or we get a peace deal, that it will not hold, and that Afghanistan, which does have this long historical record of chasing out outsiders, also has a long record of a lot of internal strife and conflict. And, you know, we've been talking about the Taliban and the current Afghan government, but you also have the presence of the Islamic State. And you could easily see this devolve. Even the Afghan government is, in some sense, sort of a compendium of warlords in different parts of the country, rather than a holistic government in the way we normally sort of presume we have these discussions.
I would add to that, Stoogeon, the elements of Al-Qaeda are still around as well. Yeah. And Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have been a little bit more simpatico through the years. Obviously, September 11th, 2001, they were. ISIS is more of a murky area, but there are multiple reports saying that they are growing in strength in the eastern part of Afghanistan. So it is an absolute mess. And you've had a number of U.S. officials through the years, including the Trump administration, saying, you know, they would only favor conditions-based withdrawal. But now it's just, I think withdrawal is sort of looking sort of inexorable.
Just to close this segment here, I will note that when you start talking about the Taliban, you talk about Al-Qaeda, you talk about the Islamic State, that's why you have a lot of people, particularly in the U.S. military, who say we need to stay in Afghanistan because the bad guys aren't going to go away. And if they're left alone, they will be able to plan and plot attacks against Americans and talk about sort of standoff attacks or standoff counterterrorism operations, which we operate from other countries in toward Afghanistan, actually won't work. There's a real debate there, and there are costs and benefits on both sides.
Well, Jim, I want to take us to another topic uppermost on U.S. foreign policy planner minds, and that would be China. It is holding a couple of major events in the coming week, the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference are both taking place. Thousands of delegates typically attend these from across the country. They gather in Beijing. The thought of thousands of people attending anything still makes people leery, even in China, which is farther along from its pandemic outbreak than many other countries. But Jim, can you give us a sense of what's going to be happening in these meetings? What's on the agenda of Chinese leaders right now, and what we should be looking for?
Well, Bob, what's going to be on the agenda is what way forward for China. COVID-19 has presented the Chinese leadership, and particularly Xi Jinping, a major challenge. Their entire model of growth has come under attack. We're seeing sort of the collapse of global trade. We're seeing the global economy slow down. China has had to dig into its reserves to stimulate its economy. It is probably going to retreat a bit on its Belt and Road Initiative. And that presents real problems for Xi Jinping. As we discussed many times in this podcast, Xi Jinping has consolidated power in a way that no Chinese leader since Mao Zedong has done. But if you have more power, you have more responsibility. So I think what people are going to be looking for coming out of this meeting, out of the People's Congress, as well as out of the People's Political Consultative Congress, is what does Xi set forth as the way China is going to go? And that's particularly going to be important in terms of economic policies. You know, how is he going to readjust China's economic plan to handle or to generate new sources of growth? And also on foreign policy, that is, does China up the talk of nationalism, leaning a little bit more forwardly into China's global ambitions and criticism of other countries? You note there's been a lot of talk about China's wolf warrior diplomacy in recent months, as China has been very aggressive in going after and criticizing foreign governments that are critical of China. I think many people regard this wolf warrior diplomacy as being counterproductive, hurting China's own interests. But for China, it plays into strong nationalist sentiments in a sense that China has long had, that it was a great power that was carved up and maltreated by other countries. So do we still see that same sort of tone coming out of the meeting? And again, the bigger backdrop is the whole issue of U.S.-China tensions, which aren't merely about economics or about trade, but in good part are about economics and trade. So are we going to see President Xi holding out, let's say, an olive branch, talking about ways to work with the United States, which he may not do directly, but talk about in terms of, for example, China's plans for its high-tech sector? Is it portrayed as a zero-sum contest or something else? So I think that's what we're really sort of trying to figure out what's going to come out. I will just note going into this meeting that, again, just as we sat down, news bulletins were hitting my email inbox saying that the Chinese have now imposed a new national security law for Hong Kong, which is essentially going to allow Beijing, whenever it wants, to impose its will on the people of Hong Kong. So that may be the first signal of China's probably going to go down a more, let's say, defiant as opposed to conciliatory road in these meetings.
It's a good point, Jim. I think people are looking very closely to see how that plays out in practice. Hong Kong protesters, as we've discussed many times on the podcast, have been both inventive and bold, and they have lots of strong contacts with outside parties. And China's trying to go right for the jugular and to snuff that out. We've also had in the past week the swearing in of a second term of Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen, who has on one part very capably handled the pandemic outbreak in her country, and also spoke out quite bluntly about how Taiwan sees China and wants no part of a one country, two systems approach. So those are two issues that are always kind of irritants for China. But I think, as you said, with this latest report and with this Congress and attempt for Xi to, you know, continue to assert himself, we're going to see, I think, nationalism play a big role.
We will. And I will simply say that nationalism can be a very positive force, but nationalism can also be a very destructive force. Just look at the history of the 20th century, not suggesting that China is the only country that has strong nationalist impulses. It isn't. However, one needs to be very careful as you start calling up the ghosts of nationalism and previous injuries done to a country. I think sort of, again, going forward is this broader issue of whether or not the United States and China can find a way to both compete and to cooperate. I think if we start heading back toward a relationship that is fundamentally competitive, both countries will be worse off for it, as well as a lot of other countries. Again, this is a different relationship than, let's say, the United States-Soviet superpower relationship or rivalry in the, you know, Cold War, where you had countries that were military opposites or opponents, but had almost no economic interaction or connection. China's integrated into the global economy. We're integrated in the global economy. It'd be pretty bumpy to do that disentangling or decoupling, but it's also likely to leave both countries and a lot of other countries much worse off. Okay, Bob, we reached the portion of our podcast. We do figures of the week. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a number, and it would be the number 18, which is the number of years since the Open Skies Treaty has been in operation. You referenced it a little while ago. This is the treaty that actually has grown. It's not just U.S.-Russia, actually. It's grown to 34 nations, and the first operational mission was 18 years ago, 2002. There have been hundreds and hundreds of flights over the participant countries, including the United States, Russia, Ukraine, Baltic states, and other places. But the treaty's been under stress for a number of years, partly due to compliance concerns. The U.S., as it had with the INF Treaty, which it withdrew from recently with Russia, has been complaining more loudly of Russian obstructions, not allowing overflights, requested overflights, for example, to Kaliningrad, the Russian enclave in the Baltic area, or parts of Georgia that Russia occupies, self-accession of Abkhazia, while at the same time concerned that Russia's gaining more and more information about U.S. capabilities, military facilities, and so forth, and sort of as it has in other such treaties, the U.S. basically saying it's giving up more than it's getting. You'll have certainly have not a number of people who are adherents of the treaty and proponents of it in the U.S. saying, on balance, it has been a win for the U.S., a transparency, but also a confidence-building measure between the U.S. and Russia, who remain the largest nuclear powers on the planet with the potential to cause a great deal of destruction would they go down a darker path. So we'll see some more. The reports just came through on this. I'm not exactly sure when it would take effect. I think there's got to be an oversight or review period of several months and so forth, but we'll see what happens. I would say one final thing, Jim, which is I mentioned the other nations in the treaty. This certainly is not going to sit well with, I think, U.S. allies in NATO who also came to see the treaty as a document that provided some sense, again, of confidence, of transparency, of what Russia, the big concern on their borders, is doing. And the U.S. leaving it like this against their concerns does not sit well.
Well, I'd be curious, Bob, as we sort of see how this all unfolded, to what extent the Trump administration consulted with or informed U.S. allies. I think a pretty standard complaint from America's allies over the course of the Trump administration is that they're often not consulted. They're just informed of decisions that greatly affect their own interests. And I think that has led to a real sobering across our many alliances and friendships about the reliability of the United States, where the United States is headed with its foreign policy. And I think that has a much larger ripple effects. I mean, it's very clear that Donald Trump does not see himself as presidents from Harry Truman to Barack Obama did, as sort of being the most important country in the world, the one that organized others toward collective action. President Trump is on I'm just going to do what I want to do. And again, the question is, okay, but how are we actually better off? What is it that we're giving up? What are we going to do in replace of this? And I haven't seen, again, this is breaking news, so I'm not necessarily criticizing the administration because the Washington Post newsflash didn't contain this. But the real big question is, what's our next step? How are we going to make sure we get the kind of information that we would have gotten through adherence in the Open Skies Treaty? I'll also just note that on the horizon is the expiration of the New START Treaty. That is supposed to expire, I think, 10 days after or 2 weeks after the next presidential inauguration. So presumably if President Trump remains president or is inaugurated for a second term, I think that treaty is likely to go by the wayside. I think if Joe Biden is the next president, there's likely to be quick movement to resurrect it. But again, there's a broader story here about this administration's hostility to international cooperation, to treaties, to formal mechanisms of sort of stipulating obligations. And in doing that, the administration doesn't then have a next step of, here's something different that we want to do. It is simply states behave as they choose to behave, and we're the biggest, most powerful country, so we'll choose as we see fit. And I should say, history does not provide lots of optimism that that sort of attitude will by itself produce prosperous outcomes.
Yeah, and I would just repeat your point about, you know, successive presidents supporting this move towards these types of treaties. It was a Republican, President George H.W. Bush, who triggered this open-skies treaty that ultimately was fully ratified and signed by 2002. But there had been this foreign policy consensus that both parties shared about the value of such treaties and the value of such oversight, especially between the U.S. and Russia. And there's been this, I wouldn't even say erosion, there's just been this drastic backsliding on such arrangements under Trump for the reasons you mentioned, Jim, and with little replacement seen other than the posturing about, you know, the importance of U.S. sovereignty and, you know, preserving the right to act as it wishes.
Yeah, and I think there's the broader lesson here is that policymakers and people talking about policy tend to spend a lot of time focused on how certain steps will solve problems and not enough time thinking about how those steps might create new, different, and possibly worse problems. And I think that's something always to keep in mind when you're talking about or assessing any administration's decisions.
Yeah, I mean, you can do a whole separate discussion just about the aftermath of the Iran nuclear deal that the administration withdrew from and what's transpired since then versus what they said would happen. But we digress. Jim, who or what is your figure of the week?
Well, Bob, this seems to be the week on The World Next Week in which we anticipate each other's figures of the week. I mentioned the Open Skies Treaty during the earlier part of the show, and you mentioned Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen, and she is my figure of the week for the very reason that you flagged. She was inaugurated this week for her second term as president of Taiwan. She won election in a landslide back in January, and she used her inaugural speech to signal that Taiwan won't back down in the face of Chinese coercion, and that she intends to go forward with her plans to find ways to lessen Taiwan's economic dependence on the mainland. As you mentioned, she once again rejected China's claim that Taiwan is Chinese territory. She said she's still willing to work with Beijing on a variety of issues, but we all know that those terms are unacceptable to Beijing because Beijing regards Taiwan as Chinese territory and as, to borrow the favorite phrase in the Chinese press, a core interest. Now, Ms. Tsai, President Tsai, has been very active trying to raise Taiwan's international presence. One selling point she's gotten over the last couple of weeks, as you pointed out, is the island's great success in battling the coronavirus. It's a country of 24 million people. It has fewer than 500 cases and just 7 deaths. Now, again, this is a country that has extensive travel going back and forth between Taiwan and China, yet it still managed to prevent the virus from taking hold. That said, Taiwan remains a country that is sort of on the outside looking in the international arena. Taiwan was not invited, for example, to join the WHO's World Health Assembly meetings this week, despite the fact that it's had great success in dealing with the coronavirus. Again, all this takes place against this broader backdrop of growing U.S. hostility toward China, not just inside the Trump administration, but outside of it. And I will note, and this is something worth paying attention to, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger both sent very rare high-level messages to Tsai congratulating her on her inauguration. Now, typically, that would be seen as an ordinary event with any other country. But remember, the United States doesn't recognize Taiwan as a country. It's governed by a separate set of rules embodied in the so-called Taiwan Relations Act, because the United States accepts the idea that there is one China. So as the United States takes steps like this, it obviously alienates and annoys Beijing. Beijing fired back, talking about how inappropriate the communications were. To some extent, this is the diplomatic equivalent of jawing the referees or the opposing players, trash talk, I guess, in sports. But it also has broader potential. The real question is, you know, where is the U.S.-China relationship headed? Because the talk coming out of Washington and the talk coming out of Beijing is a lot less conciliatory than it was even 6 months ago. And some of this harsh rhetoric may be difficult to rein in.
Yeah, I would say even in addition to talk, Jim, the actions from Washington, both messages and actions involving the U.S. vis-a-vis Taiwan are worth noting. I think there was a recent arms deal that was announced, like an additional one. There have been ongoing U.S. arms deals with Taiwan that are covered under the Taiwan Relations Act that you mentioned, Jim. But there was some additional deal recently reached. There has been some talk of Taiwan setting up some big factories in the U.S. Now, some of that talk we've heard before and it didn't really amount to much, but there seemed to be a little bit more seriousness of purpose regarding this latest round as the U.S. eyes its global supply chain and dependence on mainland China and so forth. That becomes interesting and more intriguing as well.
There it is. And again, the talk that you're hearing more and more in the United States, and I think you can see some of it in China as well, is that we're entering a new Cold War. I don't know if that's a particularly appropriate label given the differences we already talked about between sort of the U.S.-Soviet rivalry and the situation we find ourselves in today, but clearly tensions are rising. Right now, we don't see effort in either country to try to ratchet that back. And even where you've had some success, let's go back and talk about President Trump's phase one trade deal. It's not clear how long that trade deal is for the world. I mean, partly the challenge of China trying to fulfill its obligations under the treaty, just given how much sort of markets have changed in the light of the coronavirus pandemic. But there's also going to be the real issues about the interest in both sides in trying to make those deals really work. The harsher rhetoric coming out of Beijing clearly creates pressures, political pressures, maybe even opportunities for Xi to take harsher rhetorical steps and maybe actual policy steps toward the United States. Again, we've seen this in past rivalries. Tensions can flare up and then they calm down. But sometimes those tensions can go from sort of rhetorical jousting, sort of trash talk of diplomacy where you're trying to gain an edge, to sort of touching off other events that have real substantive consequences.
Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Thailand hits the 6th anniversary of its military coup, and Memorial Day is commemorated in the United States.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests on CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be healthy.